You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome to the Open Society Foundations. I am Bipasha Ray with the Open Society Fellowship, and we're delighted to host the screening of La Ola Verde that was directed by Margarita and Juanita, who's Juanita Leon, who's one of our first Open Society Fellows. The fellowship program has events like this throughout the year, so if you are interested in hearing more about these events, please feel free to sign up online for our events calendar. And we also have brochures about the fellowship program back by where the food is, so please feel free to pick up one to learn more about the program. Before the screening begins, Margarita and Juanita will offer some brief context about the film. And the film itself is 72 minutes long. So after the film has ended, we will have about half an hour for a little bit of discussion as well as questions from you all. I would like to extend a very special welcome to our distinguished guests today and just give you a very quick introduction to them. Margarita is a former Associated Press reporter, and her previous films include La Sierra, which was nominated for Best Documentary at the Independent Spirit Awards, and Roba Tierra, which won the Telesur Award at the Havana Film Festival last year. And Juanita, as I mentioned, is a former Open Society Fellow, and she, on the fellowship, she launched the Colombia's first political investigative reporting news blog called La Silla Vacía, which many of you may already be familiar with. And it was very exciting to see this partnership of Juanita teaming up with Margarita to create this film that was very independent and also very pushes back against a lot of orthodoxies, which is something that this fellowship program is very much geared towards. And I should also mention that the film itself was partially funded by our Open Society Foundation's Latin America program as well. And we're also excited to welcome Bruni Burris, who's sitting at the back. She is one of our selection committee members for the fellowship program. She's also a consultant with our OSI's National Security and Human Rights Campaign, as well as with the Sundance Documentary Film Program. She herself is also a film producer and has recently finished The Siege, which is about the 1985 siege of the Palace of Justice. So with that, let me turn it over to Margarita and Juanita to provide a little bit of context, just Margarita, and then we'll go directly to the screening. Thanks.
Hi, everybody. Thanks so much for being here. This is our second screening outside, and we're delighted to be with you and to show it. Just to give you a little bit of context, and then we'll talk about it later. Over a year and a half ago, there was the most exciting political movement in Colombia in a generation or two. And we were in February sitting in Bogota thinking, this needs to be documented. And it was so unbelievable seeing so many young people and so many people from all walks of life participating in politics. And of that excitement and that all that wave up and down and everything is this film that actually the Open Society gave us the seed money that we started with. And without it, we could have never made it because it happened so fast. Everything changed so quickly. In February, the Constitutional Court didn't allow Álvaro Uribe to run for the third time. So everything seemed that it was going to be normal, and this happened. So this is the account of this 2 months of the presidential election of 2010. So enjoy it, and we'll talk later. Thank you so much for being here.
The optimistic ending.
Well, I'm supposed to announce that, first of all, thank you, thank everyone, thank Margarita for making the film and Juanita for making the film. I'm Bruni Burris, and I'm going to moderate and host the discussion afterwards. And they've asked me to just remind everybody that this event is going to be recorded, just so you know. So as long as you're giving your permission, I guess, if you're going up to the mic and asking questions. Again, thank you both for making this film in such a timely fashion. And I think when we were talking a little bit before, and I'd seen it before, it it's been on my mind in watching the film again. I wanted to just start off with a few things and kind of ask you to bring us into the conversation deeper. It seems that as the film begins with Mokas and his kind of campaign, one of their big messages is this idea of no more breaking the rules, legality. And there's this wonderful scene at the beginning where at one of the either rallies or campaigns, the young woman is dressed as, you know, just the Miss Justice. And so I wanted to see if you could talk a little bit about, do you see this as an opening for this kind of rule of law and the demand and the hunger from for people, Colombians, for this now, for Colombia to be accountable in the rule of law? And if Mokas saw this, or is it a closing now, after Mokas wasn't elected? And just kind of like place it in history in the last kind of 25 years or how you see it and playing a role.
I think that Mokas' campaign and why his slogans were so timely and why he was so pertinent at the time, it is because with all the things, the good things, and how popular Álvaro Uribe was, he was very famous for not really abiding by the law. And when Mokas started saying those rallies full of people, life is sacred, there were judicial executions going on almost daily, and they were starting to talk about those things, not so much, but just starting. And then they say public resources are sacred, and anybody who reads any Colombian newspaper can tell you that corruption is a number one theme, and it seems that embezzlement became like a national sport. And all these slogans came at a time where there was a context, and they resonated so much in people, and also I think very much on young people who didn't live on the horrible times of the guerrillas and the paramilitaries and had to feel a little bit safer under his time, and wanted a different country, a law-abiding country, and the fears and the guerrillas coming back didn't resonate with them so much, but just of dreaming. And that was what I thought was so incredible, that a country that is so harsh and there's so many horrible things that have happened, it was a time of like dreaming, oh, I want a country like this, not, oh, no, this is bad, so I prefer this other bad option, but oh, no, I dream of a country that is like this, like that. And that was sort of like the beauty of it.
Yeah, I think this was a time of hope, more than, I mean, at the end, you know, like people are always, like they have fear and they have hope. And for a while, the message of hope of Mokas, of this country can be different, it was very powerful. And I think that even though Juan Manuel Santos won, I think that the Ola Verde allowed Santos to kind of move a little bit to the center from the right. I mean, he won on a right-wing platform, but once he won, he was able to go back to being kind of himself and be more liberal, to talk about a victims' law, a reparation for victims, and also to start putting on the agenda a battle against corruption. And I think that would have been more difficult to do if the Ola Verde around Mokas had not happened, because that opened up a space in public life to talk about different things other than security and other than, you know, like finishing off with the guerrillas. So I think that I hope that this is not like a closed period in Colombia. I think that that what Mokas and all the emotions around him showed was that people are yearning for a different kind of public life, no? And that they, of course, they are not the majority, otherwise Mokas would have won. But I think that the most modern segment of society, the younger people, the people more technologically aware, are moving in that direction, and I think that's a path that is going to follow.
I also wanted to ask you, again, of a different period in Colombian history, that it's pretty rare that your initiative, La Silla Vacía, not only was launched, but really is thriving and doing so well. It's an independent journalist blog. It's noted internationally by journalists and credited for really breaking some important stories. And then also to be an independent journalist and filmmaker in Colombia. Those are pretty rare. I mean, and so I wanted to see if you could talk a little bit about again, is that ground changing, and how you decided together to work on this, and what this means kind of opening up possibly of how documentaries are not just made but also maybe disseminated and shown in the country and the kinds of work that are being made?
I think Lacia Vasia should answer this.
Yeah, well, what I think that it has changed, not only in Colombia, but in the third world and in developing countries and in the U.S., is that technology has changed. I think that internet has opened up huge possibilities for independent adventures. And while before there were a lot of, I suppose, entrepreneurial journalists, independent journalists, they were not able to distribute the news because it was so expensive. You had to work in a newspaper with a big machine behind you. I think internet allows people like me that, you know, I had a good idea, I was willing to work a lot, I had some people that believed in me, I had Soros backing me, that's key. So that allowed me to launch La Silla Vacía, and when I was going to do it, a lot of people said, you're crazy, internet penetration is not too high in Colombia, it's only 30%, you're not going to succeed. And I was like, well, you know, let's see. You know, if I fail, it would be like doing an MBA. That's the money I have saved, and I'm going to do it. And actually, there was a market for it, and now, like, competition is starting to appear. So I think that that internet was what made that possible, and in a way that relates also to the Mulcus phenomenon, because that was a truly open source campaign. I mean, like, the people made the campaign for him. I mean, there are some people here in this room that were doing the campaign of the Green Party here, and they organized by themselves. The party never answered the phones, never had time to really connect to the people, but the people believed in an idea and worked around it. And in La Silla Vacía, it's a little bit like that. Almost half of our content is produced by people that are not part of the staff of La Silla Vacía, just because people feel that there is a community that is interesting, that they want to participate, that is worth doing it. So I feel that this is basically what's happening in every part of the world, that internet is a network that brings in people with the same interests and that allows people to produce more creative stuff just because technology is mostly free.
But also, I think what's interesting, it's not just that technology is free and you can produce this material, is that people are reading it and people are paying attention to it. That's very different.
That's true.
So maybe if you can talk a little bit about that, because I think that is a phenomenon that doesn't always happen. And I'm wondering, within Colombia, when you started it, if there was a kind of need or want or hunger for it, and like, did things kind of meet at a certain time, or how did that develop?
I have the sense that people are kind of, or at least I was really tired of always depending on the establishment. You know, like, okay, you have to depend on the Santos family and the other family. I mean, three families, three powerful groups. And I just felt that that one thing that I learned by living in the U.S. was that, you know, Americans want something, they make it themselves. They're not expecting the government to do it for themselves. And I felt like, okay, I'll try to do it. Also, I want a different kind of journalism. I want to get a different kind of information. I want to read a different kind of comments from users. I'm going to try to do it myself. I'm not going to wait for someone else to do it or to be hired or anything like that. And I think Colombia, although it has a lot of problems, Colombia is always open to new innovations, even in politics. And I think that Mulcus was evidence of that, that people felt, okay, we don't want to be exactly the same kind of politician, the same speech, the same ideas. This guy is kind of breaking the establishment. We will follow behind him. And I think that's also what Margarita has been doing with her documentaries. When most documentaries in Colombia were made by political activists, you know, that they were militants and they would do great documentaries, but really like militant documentaries, she said, you know, I'm going to do a journalistic documentary, which in the U.S. can be normal, but in Colombia that was completely revolutionary because, you know, she was not trying to advance propaganda.
Actually, for a long time, it was a weird person. I mean, I guess I am still a weird person, but a lot of them were from militants from, actually some of them from the Communist Party or some of them from the economic groups who were advancing an established agenda. So trying to do something independent, and said, no, I want to do it just as I saw it, the best way I can see it, the most truthful way. It was quite revolutionary. And people come and say, how did you do that? How did you? Because there are just only two TV channels, as you know. And all my three long feature-length documentaries had been able to shown on TV, some on primetime, and that was amazing, and there were all kinds of cover and everything. But others not on primetime, and still we can, you know, sort of like open a window. And with platforms like La Silla Vacía and trying to team with other independent people, we're saying, okay, how can we advance an agenda that is not the normal agenda of what the minister says or what the, you know, what other says, but let's try to show things in a different way that in Colombia have never been seen. So that's sort of like the challenge and the path we're trying to walk.
I just want to ask you if you can share, how widely has this film been seen in Colombia, by in different areas and by who, and what has been the response?
We did a premiere at a theater, and Caracol showed it, which is one of the two main channels. But now we're trying to do the next step on how to reach people that didn't see it at that time on TV or that, whatever. But just the next step and trying to break the sort of like the neck of the distribution that they have there. Though if they see it on TV in a bad timing,
it's not.
I mean, 4 million people see it, you know. Because there are only two TV channels.
Yeah. So 5 million people saw it when we showed it on Caracol. But our idea now is to put it online and allow people to download it.
Will you also be taking it to different parts of the country and showing it in
communities? Yeah, we have been invited to Medellin, Cali, Villavicencio. So now that we finally recovered from this effort, we are going to start traveling around and showing it in different towns.
Okay, maybe we can open up the questions and from people in the audience.
I'm Paco Deonis, and I'm a documentary film producer and friends with Margarita Juanita too. But I was just thinking about the green wave generation, right? And I couldn't help but think of course, Egypt and Tunisia. And you know, it's true that technology is allowing these connections to happen and these movements to happen. But then I wonder what's happening to them as the results don't happen the way they hoped or as quickly as they hoped, or, you know, and so specifically in Colombia, it's been a year now. What's happened to the green generation?
Well, the candidates, for example, Antanas Mocu, and we'll do this for the international version of like a follow-up, but since there have not been definite developments, we're waiting. But Antanas Mocu, they offered him to run for governor of the state that where Bogota is. And Enrique Peñalosa will run for a mayor of Bogota. And Sergio Fajardo is going to run in the October elections for to be the governor of Antioquia, where Medellin is. And Lucho Garzón is the spokesperson for the Green Party. But besides like the figures, there are many people organizing in different parts of Colombia, with the party or outside the party, but with that same philosophy. So there's like a seed there that we'll see where it would go. But you see the energy and sort of like saying, okay, you beat us this time, but there's something we still have to say. And I think that generation that participated in that, I don't know if they're going to go left, right, whatever, but I think those are the people that will be the politicians of the future, and they live through that. So we hope they will be a different type.
Yeah, there was some depression in the beginning when he lost. People were so depressed. It was amazing. Like the young people, they were like, no one was watching La Silla Vacía for the first month because they were like, we don't want to know anything about politics after this. This is, they really felt, I feel betrayed. And I think that in a way, people have felt quite disappointed with the Green Party after all that effort and all that energy, that they have not been able to channel that. And to, you know, when Mocu says, now what, now everything, and then nothing much happened in the first months. So a lot of people felt really disappointed. But I feel that because that was like an open source campaign, people realized up to a point, like, okay, we'll stop waiting for those old guys. We are just going to to keep on holding the dream together. And a lot of them, at least in that I know of, at least in Bogota, Cali, Medellin, and Villavicencio, they are now running for juntas administradoras locales that are like the local councils of the towns. So they're running with the same agenda by themselves, and they're hoping that the party will back them up. But I do feel like, Margarita, that there was like a political awakening, and although some people were very disillusioned, other people kind of said, okay, we still have to fight for it. So,
is there one kind of uniformed message or agenda on the Green Party? Because that, I mean, what's interesting about the film, you kind of feel like they're searching for it on the road in the campaign. And so I wonder, with all of these different initiatives, genuine ones, authentic ones, coming up, are they forming their own based on kind of the local needs and then seeing how it fits kind of generally with it? Or is there some kind of main messages still that are coming out or being put together?
What I see in the people, like in the normal people, not the big shot politicians, in the local people, is that they are more green than the candidates. I mean, they want to be more environmental, and they're organizing around environmental issues. They believe in, you know, in this idea of law abiding, life is sacred, and of doing like transparent politics. That's like a big thing, you know, like we want to do politics in a different way. So I think that is quite uniform along the path. I think that in the big figures, there's now a division because Peñalosa, that is running for mayor in Bogota, has showed a interest in President Uribe supporting him, and that has been felt as a betrayal by the people following Mocus and by the Mocus side. By the Green Party base, definitely. But I feel that at the base, there is quite a consensus of what they want to become. So we'll see how long it...
Vera Lauer, communications person and a Bruni's fan. I have two questions. One, was the communications campaign designed with certain models or prototypes? If so, from where? And the second one is that, do you believe like Colombia has a pattern of just embracing like, you know, of sort of ideas and creative and non-conventional orthodox ways of thought?
Colombia has a pattern of that. What would you say? I don't think so. I mean, he's very unique and eccentric guy for Colombia. I don't know if for the world, but for Colombia, he's incredibly creative and innovative. And he really breaks all the, you know, like the rules and the thing. And in the past, it's a country that has lived for so long in a war or a low-intensity war. Eccentricity is not so much the rule. It's like always like, you read their newspapers like 30 years ago, they seem like today, you know, like some peasant people were massacred, the land were taken away, this politician was killed, these other, I mean, they seem like forever. So I think more in war and peace seeking societies, this eccentricity at least was unheard of. And about the communications pattern, I don't think so. I think they were really, well, Mocus is sort of like, for Latin America at least, he's such an iconic figure, and you will go to Mexico and lots of the Latin American cities, and he has gone and consult there on how, I don't know if you say in English, cultural citizenship, and basically how to change people's minds to do things differently in a more civilized way. And so he has his own thing. And I can assure you that they didn't look it up in any books or any international consultant to sort of do that. It was like a combination between of a leader that has a vision, and really his life is exactly like his vision, that he's austere and sincere and transparent, and his campaign was like that. But no, there were no books that they were following or international people that advised it. Actually, the Venezuelan strategist from the other campaign, he couldn't believe it. He said, oh, when you showed it in a festival, like in a city like Washington, the political consultants are not going to believe it. Like, there's a recipe for this, you know? And they didn't have, like, the recipe. It's just you can do whatever, but there's, like, a main recipe that you have to follow. And these guys are, what were they thinking?
Hi, my name is Santiago. I'm confused by maybe a very basic thing, and that's how genuine is and was Mokus's interest in becoming president. You know, he struck me as an idealist in many ways, and with values that all of us want to emulate. But I didn't see a lot of pragmatism. He didn't display any vision. Perhaps that's just what's depicted in your film. But my question is, and then you just said he was offered to run for governor in of the state Bogotá is in. So it doesn't, I don't perceive as though he is aggressively interested in having this role in being the leader of Colombians.
Yeah, I think that was a question in a lot of people's minds, and also I questioned myself many times if he really, really wanted to be president, because he made so many mistakes and boycotted. You know, he really did a boycott of his own campaign, right? So I was like, okay, you know, it's good to be like a genius and have like this vision. I do think he had a great vision, but he didn't have a strategy, because he felt that, you know, that's what Hector Rivero says in the film, that having a strategy was a little bit disrespectful to voters, because he was kind of manipulating them, which is crazy for a political campaign, in my opinion. So I think that, and I think that I really love the speech that Margarita recorded, that no one had that kind of footage, where he says that, you know, maybe his fear of having so much responsibilities, of being an immigrant, and, you know, when you are like the guy that is going to put the ball in, you know, and they say you cannot miss it, and I think he was really, I think that he was kind of scared at some point, and that, because it's difficult to explain how, when he was doing so well, things started to go so bad. And I think that part of it was that, of course, we were coming from 8 years of Uribismo. People really believed in this president, right-wing president. The president used a lot of the resources of the state to campaign for Santos, which is prohibited in Colombia. You know, it was very difficult to win when Santos had all the power behind him, the media, the politicians, the money, everything. But Mokus had a lot of responsibility in losing. I mean, he really didn't have a real strategy. So I guess that's what you question. A lot of people in his campaign and outside thought the same thing, you know.
Well, there's this scene where Lucho asks Santana, okay, what campaign are you helping? And that was the feeling that those days, it's like, what is happening? There were 3 or 4 days that were, oh, please, what is going on? And he said in a very humorous way, but that was what everybody was thinking. I don't know if outside the campaign, but inside the campaign, it was like, what's going on?
My name is Juan Carlos Velasquez, and I'm a video producer, and I congratulate you, this wonderful material and access to this campaign, and we can see this behind the scenes. I would like to take advantage of the producer and the director is here to tell us a little bit about the documentary itself. Like, do you spend how many days with them, and how many material do you have? And you were when you were filming, you were saying, "Oh, I'm going to," or how many hours? Because I imagine you have, I don't know, tons of hours. And how was that creative process and that feeling to be like inside? That was wonderful, and it's like seeing those hugs and those like innocent moments of the candidate that make look so naive and nice and a little silly to Fantanas.
Well, there's several wonderful filmmakers here, so editors, everything. So when we used to tape, I knew how many hours I had, but I calculated that we had more than 100. There were days that we were filming, that I was filming with a small camera. You see some of the footage is in his house. I filmed by myself, and I have never shot before.
And in the airplane, there was just, let's say, it was a small airplane. They say, okay, one seat, but it was, you know, for me, not for someone they didn't know. So I had to. So some days I filmed and the crew filmed at the same time. So we had 8 hours or something. And we filmed like 2 months, basically, all the time. And then on and off a few days after and many days before and many days after. And when we were doing, we thought at some point that he was going to win. So I was looking at Lula's documentary, saying, oh, this is going to be an eight-scene documentary of how he's going to win this amazing, eccentric, incredible candidate. And then other times I'm like, oh, this is not looking so well. So we were not doing a script. We were just like, every day was like an upside down, upside down, upside down. And also it was a short period of time because, you know, in March he had 3%. In April he had 38%. In May apparently he was in a tie. And then May 30th it was knockout. And June 20th was just like, you know, like nothing. So yeah, we had lots and lots and lots of material, and we didn't have a script. We were working as we go. The editor was every day that we came from filming, so the you know, the tour, let's say, or the political tour, I don't know exactly how you say it. It was 2 days or 3 days, and then we came back, and he was seeing the material. And at night, sometimes we saw it, but sometimes we were so tired. They were really, really, really long days. And so we were, and all, at the same time, we were trying to fundraise. So we had to do demos and a 3-minute demo, a 5-minute demo, a 10-minute demo. And then, oh, no, I want to see something else, or like a 20. So we were at the same time editing, shooting. But when we really finished, I think we had more than 100 hours or something like that of material.
Hi, Laura Hernandez. I'm a journalist, and I really want to ask you about Sergio Fajardo's role. I'm very, very curious to really know why Sergio Fajardo is not appearing as much as the rest of the candidates. Like, we see Lucho, we see Peñalosa, but Sergio Fajardo at the end is not as present as the rest. I know that he fell down on the bike, but he was campaigning too, and I don't know why.
He was not campaigning. He was. He had a really, really, really terrible accident. So he was in. He went to surgery, and then it was a very, very painful recovery. Sometimes he couldn't even be in the phone, in the conference calls. So basically, he joined the movement around the beginning of April, and then by, I think the end of April, he had the accident. The bike accident. So basically, most of the time we shot him. We shot the documentary. He wasn't in, and after he was in surgery, he couldn't leave his house. He was like in therapy, and the recovery was slow and very, very painful. So, and that was a very painful loss for the Green Party. But that's the reason that he wasn't there.
Okay. Thank you, Carlos Macias. I'm a journalist, and I have a question about how is it to be a journalist in Colombia today? Because under Uribe's government, either you are with us or against us. So, you know, any journalist that will try to cover power or try to do something like that, it will be probably targeted many different ways. So what is the current climate for journalism?
Well, I think that the experience is very different if you are a local journalist in a little town or if you are a national journalist like myself. I've never been threatened, which is always kind of disappointing for international audiences, because that kind of people think, oh, she's not a good journalist because she hasn't been threatened. But actually, a lot of journalists have not been threatened because it's not a... It's not exactly like you cannot say anything in Colombia. I mean, no, you can, especially if you work for a national media, you can say a lot of things and you are not threatened. So I feel that, of course, it's not a, you know, I think that in Colombia we use a lot of euphemisms to say things. I mean, when I was at Semana, we were like, okay, these bad apples in the army. I mean, you couldn't say like, okay, this is a systematic violation of human rights. But when I came to La Silla Vacía, I told the reporters that work with me, like, we are not going to use euphemisms. You know, we are going to say it like that, and we'll see what happens. and we said it and nothing happened, and probably it's because we're not so powerful. Maybe as more people read us, we get into more problems. But what I have seen is that there is a space to say a lot of things as long as you are not seen as working for the guerrillas, or which sometimes a lot of journalists are not seen, are not working for the guerrillas, but they are seen like that because they only uncover scandals in the army or violations of the army, and they never, you know, it's like, which I think is perfectly okay to do that, but in Colombia is not, it's dangerous to do that, to be seen as functional to one side of the conflict. And I've always tried before that, before La Silla Vacía, I covered the war in Colombia for 10 years. I wrote 2 books about it, and I made a point of always covering all sides so that it would not be seen as partisan. And I thought that was like a smart thing to do, although I think it's perfectly okay if you just want to uncover military abuses or guerrilla abuses, but in Colombia, that's dangerous. But I would say, you know, how is it to be a journalist in Colombia? It's a lot of fun because you never have a problem finding stories. You know, like, you know, we plan a story in the morning at La Silla Vacía, and by 2 o'clock we have sometimes changed the story, the opening story, 2 times because, like, something even more important happened. So after working in the U.S. for a long time, I was always kind of saying, oh, I want to tell this story, and then I would Google it, and a lot of people had said it before. In Colombia, that never happens, you know. In Colombia, it's like everything is to be told. And so I think it's quite exciting, and you should go back.
Hi, Mary Morrison. Also had a lot of fun as a journalist in Colombia quite a long time ago. Now, unrelated question. To what extent was this actually a green campaign? It was funny that we saw a lot about the law and truth, but absolutely nothing really about the environment.
So people asked them too. You know, they were like, well, what is the green part about it? For example, there was this discussion of a mine company who is trying to get gold from this beautiful páramo, this very high up mountain that is the place where many rivers are born, and they were, what's your position about it? And I remember Moku says, no, I'm a law-abiding person. If there's already a contract between the government and the mining company, I would respect it. They were like...
Yeah.
So a lot of the green activists were like, oh, my God.
Yeah, he really lost a lot of the green votes, the real green votes, when in a debate that we were coordinating at La Silla Vacía, they asked him about fumigation. And he said that unless we found a better solution for fumigating coca, he was okay with it. And we were all like, okay, that's not a green answer. So, yeah, no, they weren't very green. But the base is really green. You know, yeah. Like the militants, they really are people that are working like in little towns for the river sites and things like that. But I would say that the party is not green in that sense.
How did they come up with the name then for their party?
It was an existing party.
I think it was more like hope.
Yeah, exactly. Actually, our name was the Green Wave. But since the Iranian movement was also the Green Wave, and there's a documentary about that, we had to change the name.
But it's good. The new name.
There was another question. Congratulations for the work. I'm really excited that finally we got to meet after emailing each other, Margarita. But besides that, I just want maybe to ask, after Antanas, you know, he knew he looks like in the documentary that he knew he was about to lose for the second round. He knew it, and I think it's really genuine from Antanas to say, let's try to get more votes, even though Santos wins, because that's better for the country. I don't want to win. But I just want to ask you how you saw him at the end. What was his because I've seen him personally. I know he was really drained, and he was really sad, and he didn't want to talk, and he got isolated. But maybe people who's here don't know how hard it was for him and for the rest of his campaigners to lose. So if you could actually explain being there next to him,
how you saw him when they lost the elections.
You mean the second time?
Yeah.
Well, I think the runoff was sort of like a procedure. It was already, the first round was such a knockout that no one expected anything from the runoff. It was actually really painful to sort of try running when you knew you were losing already. By the margin was 25%, 25 points. So it was, there was no way. So it was, yeah, it was. Can you, you saw those debates where they were, I cannot see them anymore. They were so painful. And every time we see them, it's like, why did you answer this? Why did you answer that? And do you remember this, her campaign manager who was doing like that? It was just like that all the time. It was like, I meet people all over and they say, oh, I suffered so much for him. He was like, go, go. So I think that was like he was exhausted, and there was no hope of winning, and it was, you know, sort of useless to even to keep going. So it was very, very sad and disappointing time. And also we were still, I mean, everybody that sort of followed the elections, like, what happened? What happened? How come the poll said one thing and the difference was so huge? So that was like a permanent question all over. Did I answer your question, John? Sort of.
I think we have to end it here, but I wanted to thank again Margarita and Juanita, and really to thank all of you for coming, and thank OSI for making this happen.
Thank you so much for coming.
So quickly for us.